On the surface, Chris and Karen Pugh seemed to have a picture-perfect life.
Chris was tall, fair-haired, nice-looking, and he seemed to love Karen.
She really did seem happy with Chris. She was in love, happy, and very hopeful.
The kids were spotless. The house was spotless. Even doing a 13-hour-a-day working, there was nothing out of place. Nothing.
But the cleanest house in town hides some very dirty secrets.
Chris's sisters accused Karen of seeing people.
You start finding out things, and it just don't make sense to you. I really was shocked.
He would change. He was very Jekyll and Hyde.
When I see him, two broken legs.
Love may be blind and marriage bliss, but divorce is murder. In 1981, Karen Klee, a young nurse and single mother, meets handsome house contractor Chris Pugh at a local pub in Barry, Wales. They quickly become inseparable. Chris takes Karen's firstborn child, Deanne, under his wing. Karen is smitten.
Karen was saying that Chris was the one. She said he was lovely. She planned to marry him, and he was good with Deanne. You made her happy.
Her family is pleased that she has found a husband.
When Karen found somebody that she could love, and I thought loved her, and the second is because with a baby, they don't always want to take on baggage, as they put it. But Chris seemed to be all right with Deanne. So in two respects, I thought Karen was pretty lucky there to find both worlds, if you like.
Just 2 months after meeting, they are married. And Karen's parents put aside any worries about hasty nuptials.
And I said, have you thought about it? And she said, yes. I said, well, if it's what you want, you've got to pick your own. I can't pick your husband's for you. She was in love, happy, and very hopeful.
Karen wanted to get married, and what her wish was our wish. And I mean, I couldn't at the time think of anything to deter her from it because there was nothing.
Family means a lot to them. Karen is very tight with her parents, and Chris is especially close to his sisters. They are all delighted that the marriage will tie the knot between Chris and Karen and the two families forever. The newlyweds waste no time in making a new life together. And in 1982, just 9 months after their wedding, Karen and Chris welcome their son, Michael, into the family.
Karen was an amazing mother. She was very optimistic. She used to see things from everyone else's point of view. She was very much the family negotiator.
Karen was a very good mother, a lot of time for her children. She always put them first. She always bought her children things. They were well-dressed, clean and tidy.
Every time I went over there, she was always ironing because they would have a certain outfit on through the day and then, for some reason, get changed. So constant washing and ironing was over Karen's. I remember as I got older, I used to help her out with the ironing because she'd just be stood there for hours with baskets of ironing.
And she crocheted. She used to crochet the most beautiful hats with the big baubles on them in the 80s. And It was beautiful. She had all the patience go in to do it.
Karen also works full-time as a nurse.
She was a very caring person, very patient with people. She had a very good sense of humour. You know, she was, you know, always up to have a laugh and a joke with people. Very enthusiastic.
And Chris is a real catch and great with the kids.
Chris was tall, fair-haired, nice-looking. Quite a nice body on him. More handsome, I would say. Yeah, we were all happy that that Karen had met Chris, and we thought Chris was a good person. He provided for the children, and he seemed to love Karen.
He always went to work. He was never out of work. You know, in all fairness, in every respect of, he was a good dad with the kids, and he was good with his money with Karen. He made sure that they had food and everything like that.
He worked, he provided for them. So they went on holiday as a family.
Every year we used to go on holiday. From the age of 12, Mum and Dad started taking us abroad. So we started like experiencing Spain.
She looked happy in the photos that they showed us. She seemed to have a good time. She liked to go out to bingo one night a week. She and Chris would look after the kids while she went. On the weekend, they went to the club and had a dance and met their friends down there.
But in the early months of their marriage, Karen's family begins to notice that Chris has some strange habits.
He wanted to know where she was, or if she came out, you know, he'd be peering out the window, seeing her with, you know, them in a taxi cab, you know. You just watch it all the time.
He would often go through a handbag, a coat pockets, a purse even. Like did say, well, why'd you let him? Do you go through his wallet? She said he just does it. He's always done it.
He would question her, what she'd done, who'd she seen, where did she go? And that continued every day.
He treated her well if she was doing what she was supposed to be doing. Or she'd done something that he was jealous about, then he would change. He was very Jekyll and Hyde.
Chris, he was a very tall man. I mean, he just oozed authority. Even if he walked into a room, the presence and aura around him was just authority.
Karen believes that it's in her family's best interest if she doesn't upset her husband and goes along with his requests.
Provided she was done what he wanted her to do, everything was fine.
Forensic psychologist Brian Russell and psychotherapist Stacey Kaiser believe that the Pews are setting themselves up for a volatile situation.
When you normalize profoundly inappropriate behavior, it's as if your barometer or your radar starts to get skewed. You become to where you're not calibrated anymore to what should strike you as disturbing.
It's a bad habit to get into, to start to adapt to bad behavior. So for someone like Karen, who's starting to view Chris's controlling behavior as normal, this could enable his controlling behavior to become more frequent.
That's dangerous, because something will have to get really, really bad before you'll recognize that you're in a dangerous situation.
2 years into the marriage, Karen's friend Bridget has an unsettling encounter with Chris at her home.
He would follow her about because he didn't trust her. I mean, I remember when the children were younger, he sent them over to my house to see if I knew where Karen was. So when the children knocked the door and asked me, I said, no, sorry, I haven't seen him today. And I looked over across the road and I saw his head appear from behind a white van. I thought, that's a bit strange.
Not only is Chris's behavior strange, his family is not quite what it seems either. He waits until after they are married to divulge the truth. It turns out that Chris's sister is really his mother, and that his parents are really his grandparents.
And he said, she's my mother. And I said, who's your mother? And I said, are you just saying that, Chris? He said, and I accidentally found out when I was about 16. You start finding out things, and it just don't make sense to you. And I was so shocked when Chris told me. I really was shocked.
I think, like, if you think back, like, it makes probably a lot of sense of why he's a bit weird in the head, if you get me. I don't know, might mess some people up.
Our first relationships are with our families. So for someone like Chris, who was deceived by his own family and told that someone was his mother who was not, this could create a foundation for mistrust. Makes sense to me that he begins to not trust his own wife, that he has control issues, that he has to watch her because his foundation has been so rattled that he doesn't know who he can count on.
But as the years go by, Chris's controlling behavior only gets worse.
I warned him a couple of times, do not hit her. I may be little, but I'm not scared.
By 1983, Karen Pugh is a devoted wife and mother of two, running an immaculate household in Barry, Wales. And her husband, Chris, is working hard to provide for his growing family.
She ran a good house, good mother, and a good wife.
But 2 years into their marriage, Chris becomes paranoid. So much so that he accuses Karen of having an affair with a neighbor.
He thought that she had a man friend. The only friends that she had was the people that she went to bingo with, and they were women.
Despite the fact that his accusations are unfounded, Chris lashes out at her, and Karen ends up badly bruised. The tension also mounts between Chris and Karen's families.
I went round to Karen's, knocked on the door. Karen answered. She had bruising. She was crying. I said, where is he? And Karen said Chris had gone to his mother's. I said, that's okay, I'll wait here till he comes back. Chris come back with three sisters. And they come to tell Karen off for the way that she was treating their brother. I told them to go away, otherwise they would be in serious trouble with me. I told Chris to leave. It was Karen's place, not his. I told him to go back to his mother and find somebody else. But Karen didn't want that. Karen wanted him back, so back he came.
Chris's family has a completely different take on what is really going on between Karen and Chris.
Chris's sisters went and accused Karen of seeing people when she went to bingo. They'd been told that she was seeing somebody else, and it wasn't the way to act when you were married and when you got children. And his sisters believed him. Basically, they believed him and didn't see two sides of it.
The sisters accuse Karen of provoking their brother with her flirtatious behavior.
They were older than me, and they spoiled Chris. He was baby brother. Of course, one turned out to be his mother, so naturally she was going to stick up for her son. And the other two were aunties.
Karen's family takes her side.
They thought because I was little that I wouldn't do much, but I was feisty. I did plenty. I told them, if I catch Chris, just gotta catch Chris hitting Karen, I would break his arms. And I told him straight, I may be little, but I'm not scared.
Families often see what they want to see. And so they have this idealized version of Chris. They think he's so perfect and wonderful that they believe that the only reason he'd be behaving in this abusive way was because Karen was causing it.
I went up there and I said to him one day, you know, I said, you're going to hit her once too often, Chris. And he said, what do you mean by that? I said, because I'll end up killing you. And he started to laugh, and I said, I don't joke about things. How many trees and bushes do you pass coming home? And which one am I going to jump out of? You tell me and look for it.
Karen's family pleads with her to leave Chris.
I said, please, please leave. You can get a place, you can find a place to live. Just move away, you and the kids, and stay away from him.
I always said that she'd be better off leaving him, but she wasn't prepared to leave him because she didn't think it was fair on the children for them to be without their father.
And she said, when the children are old enough, she said, I'm going to leave. So she had every intention of leaving but wouldn't leave because they were a family unit.
In her mind, she couldn't keep the kids. they should be kept. In other words, clothes, food, wanting to go somewhere and all that jazz. She wouldn't have been able to do it out of her wages. How can I stay away from it? I couldn't earn enough money to keep the kids. Should I gotta go back?
The troubled family continues to grow. In 1984, Karen gives birth to her daughter, Louise. And in 1986, she has her fourth and final child, Samantha.
She realized how trapped she was. But she was gonna leave him anyhow. She did tell us that when the youngest, which is Samantha, when she was of age, she was gone. She'd done her duty to all the kids. She'd brought them all up. And the other three were already settled anyhow.
But no matter the state of their marriage, Karen and Chris escape their problems by taking idyllic vacations together, often just the two of them. On these trips, Chris is like a different person.
She loved holidays, beaches, whatever. They all went as a family and they all went together. And he was as good as gold while they were on holiday and everything. He was absolutely marvellous.
By the early 90s, a decade into their marriage, these vacations don't seem like such a good idea to Karen's friends.
I said to her one time, aren't you frightened about going away with him on your own? What if he pushes you over a cliff after an argument? And she laughed at me and said, no, he always treats me like a princess when it's just the two of us.
But the happy vacation time doesn't last. Back home, Chris and Karen's marriage continues to spiral, and the tension between Karen's family and Chris's is getting worse. It reaches a boiling point when Lorraine learns that Karen has a broken arm.
And Kathleen received a phone call from Karen saying that Chris had hit her again. So Pauline and I ran to her car. We went over to Karen's. I picked up a piece of wood. I go in Karen's and I say to her, where is he? And I didn't find him, sorry. And I'm saying loud enough because I know he's not far away, he's just hiding. Tell him, when I see him, two broken legs. But that day I picked up this piece of wood and I would have used it.
Karen confesses to her father that her marriage is vastly different from what she had hoped for.
I went there one day and she was in bed. And she said, she only wanted to be like you and Mum. She wanted to be a good housewife. She modelled herself on us. And that's all she wanted. She wanted a husband, she wanted the children, and she'd give everything to them.
Pretty much every little girl grows up wanting to find her Prince Charming. So to begin to see that your relationship has taken a turn for the worse and that it's hopeless and that you really don't think you're ever gonna have that is devastating, it's traumatic.
At the end of her rope, Karen decides to go on vacation, and it will change her life.
And then she said to me one day, I met a fella out there. She said, he's from Cardiff. She was full of life again.
The violence in Karen and Chris Pugh's marriage is escalating. Karen's family encourages her to take some time away from him.
It got worse and worse. It got worse and worse, and everybody could see it.
And eventually, it wore her down.
In February 2002, at the lowest point in her marriage, Karen decides to go to Torrelino, Spain, for a week-long vacation. She's ready for a dramatic change in her life. When Karen gets back, friends and family notice a complete change in her.
She had lots of colour in her face and she was really happy. She was always smiling, always excited. She was just like a different person.
And there's a good reason for her newfound happiness.
In the beginning, Karen didn't tell us. We didn't have a clue. We just said to her, you had a good holiday. It was superb, she said. And that was the indication that she enjoyed what was happening there.
John is a 51-year-old landscape gardener from just outside Cardiff, Wales. After meeting in Spain, the two become romantically involved.
She didn't tell us that she'd met someone or anything for ages. And then she said to me one day, I met a fella out there. She said, he's from Cardiff. And I said, oh, yeah.
You could see the difference in Karen. Karen became happier. Her whole face used to light up when she spoke about John.
He used to buy her flowers a lot. He always bought her flowers, and she used to appreciate that because that's something that Chris never really did.
Karen continues her relationship in secret.
It's like she'd had a breath of fresh air. She was relaxed. She was laughing more. Things just more ease.
Her needs have not been met for so long, and now she finally finds somebody who is attentive and interested, and it feels good to her. And so rather than just leave her husband, she begins to see him on the side, almost as if he's filling the holes that Chris has left open.
I think that Karen was escaping temporarily, periodically, from the relationship with Chris that she knew was failing. Something like starting an extramarital affair instead of getting out of the marriage adds a whole extra layer of complexity to getting out of the marriage.
Even though they are both married, according to Karen, her holiday romance is about to get serious.
The thing is, he's married, but he doesn't get on with his wife. Oh, I said, don't say you're falling for that story. And she said, no, it's true. He doesn't get on with his wife. And so we're going to start meeting. And I said to her, well, you be careful because of Chris. I said, you know what he's like, Kat? I said, you just be careful with it.
I said, well, you have to ask yourself, did you still have any feelings for Chris? And she told me, no, I don't love him anymore. And I said, well, you're a decent person, Karen. You've got to do the decent thing and tell him.
But Karen is too scared to tell him. By spring, after carrying on the affair for a few months and buoyed by her new romance, Karen realizes it's time to make her move and get out of her relationship with Chris. Karen's youngest daughter, Samantha, is now 15. Deanne and Michael, in their early 20s, and Louise, 18, have all moved out of the house. Karen feels that it's no longer necessary to stay with Chris for her kids.
All of a sudden, Karen came to me and said, can I come down here to live? And I said, I suppose. And she said, I'm leaving Chris. And can I come down here? And I said, yes, you can come down here. What about the kids? No, no kids. There's only Sam left, and Chris can look after Sam. She'll be fine. I'm leaving.
Karen moves out. And surprisingly, Chris doesn't put up much of a fight.
He would knock the door with some chocolate for Karen, and Karen would say, I don't want to see him. And I'd say, Karen doesn't want to talk to you. Just go away, Chris.
After years of accusing Karen of having affairs, Chris can't imagine that his wife might now actually be having one. He's convinced that the two of them are getting back together, since, according to him, they've been seeing each other. He even tells his youngest daughter, Samantha, that he is reconciling with her mother.
Samantha had come down to my house, and my boyfriend was there. Basically, she just turned around and said, oh, Mum and Dad are getting back together, and she was really buzzing. And my boyfriend turned around and said, no, they're not, she's met someone new.
Samantha is the last in the family to find out. She's shocked by the news. Hoping to help her father face the truth, she tells him of her mother's affair. When Chris hears about it, he behaves like a man obsessed.
He was becoming a right stalker. Karen slept at my front room, and she had the bed in there. And he could only just see over the window because the window was high. So it was just a pair of eyes looking in. And she'd say to me, oh, ma'am, Chris is looking in again. I said, pull the curtains and can't see. So, which Karen would do.
Well, he kept coming down house and wanted to see Karen. We told him, you know, no, it's finished. And used to sit on the wall watching, waiting.
He wanted Karen back. And Karen wasn't going back. There was no way Karen was ever going back there. When he was off from work, he was there. Weekends, he was there nearly all day long. Up there, over there, down there. Whichever way. And he was there.
Chris has always been possessive of Karen from the very beginning. And now that she seems to be slipping away, that he's afraid maybe that he'll leave her, his controlling behavior escalates. He needs to know more, watch her more, possess her more.
When people start to get desperate, irrational courses of action start to seem reasonable to them.
Everyone is on edge.
Just lost his head. Like, I caught him outside my nan's on the Wednesday. He was pacing back and forth past my nan's garden, like, and I said to him, what are you doing down here? And he said, like, and he showed me a gun. He said, I got a gun, I'm gonna shoot that John. I know he's in there with your mother. And I said, oh, come on now. I said, don't do that, you'll end up in prison. What about us kids? And he said, fuck you kids, I just want your mother back. On the Thursday, I went to warn my mum that I'd caught him outside there with a handgun.
It was crazy because I said to her, look, if I go to the police, I said, I can have him for being stalking. She said, you can't say he's stalking me. I said, well, what's he doing? He is stalking you as far as I'm concerned. And I said, but it's not only you, Claire, there's me. He won't touch you, Mum. She said, he'll never touch you. So she said, you're quite safe, it's only me.
Karen is so immune to his behavior now that she doesn't have any emotion about it. She's so cavalier because she's learned to be detached.
Often people in abusive relationships get desensitized, and their threshold for what seems violent to them rises to a point that would be hard for the rest of us to understand.
It's really dangerous because it's literally like a slowly bubbling pot that I fear will ultimately bubble over.
Despite Chris's stalking, every once in a while, Karen visits him at her old house and periodically sleeps over there. Everyone speculates about what is going on.
Maybe she thought in her own little mind that if she went back with him and spoke to him, that it'd smooth things over.
She must have thought, oh, just go and, you know, go over, keep him happy, you know, so he don't start.
Chris's family has a different take on the situation. They claim that she is dating Chris at the same time as John, and not just trying to smooth things over with Chris. They are convinced that she is leading her husband on.
Made out that Karen was the one that was in the wrong. She was the one having the affair, and Chris was desperately trying to get the marriage back on track. He bought new clothes. He was making more of an effort with himself, and he wanted to take her out for dinner and things like that.
Karen led him to believe that everything was going to be okay with them, that they were going to be back together.
I actually have two theories for why I think Karen is still seeing Chris. Number one, I think she still has feelings for him. I also think it's possible that Karen's afraid of Chris, that she is hoping if she continues to see him, sleep with him occasionally, that she might be able to temper his emotions and keep him content.
I think that sometimes people in volatile relationship situations aren't 100% sure what they want to do. And so they tend to keep multiple doors open while they get sure.
Despite her husband's close watch, Karen's new relationship with John grows more serious.
I think she was in love with John. She'd called to the house and she was discussing John and what she was going to do. She wanted to move out of Barry.
Finally, she makes a move that pushes Chris to the brink.
He went, he said to me, I gotta go. He went, didn't even say where he was going, he just said he was going.
On June 22, 2002, Karen visits her boyfriend John in Cardiff for the day. According to Karen, they've both decided to file for divorce so they can finally be together.
Karen left me at lunchtime and she said to me, I'll see you later, Mum, I won't be late. And off she went. And then in case 6:30, Karen hadn't come back. And I said to Peter, Karen said she wouldn't be late. I just wondered where the heck Karen was. And I thought, oh, I know what's happened. She's met one of her girlfriends and she's gone for a blinking drink, not phoning and letting me know.
That evening, Karen's parents get a series of phone calls from Chris. He's looking for Karen too.
About 6:40, the phone went. And it was Chris on the phone. And he said, is Karen there? I said, no. And he said, you don't know where she is? I said, no, I don't. And that was it. Then again, about 7:00, he done it again. Is Karen there? No. You still don't know where she is, Kath? No, Chris, I don't know where she is. At 10:30, he phoned again. Peter took the phone. He said, for God's sake, Chris, give it a break. She's not here. Now leave us alone. Don't phone anymore. And put the phone down. And that was the last we heard of Chris.
I don't think that Chris ever thought that Karen would leave him. She put up with so much of his inappropriate behavior. I really think that he thought he had her for life.
Chris viewed Karen like an object. Through Chris's eyes, it probably looked as it would look if someone drove off in your car, as if somebody were literally taking your prized possession and running off with it. That's a whole different kind of emotion.
When Karen still has not returned from Cardiff the next morning, her parents really begin to worry. The series of phone calls from Chris has added to their anxiety. They start calling around to see if anyone has heard from her. Across town, Karen's sister, Pauline, gets a phone call from her niece's mother-in-law, Mo, who has spent the evening drinking with Chris. And she's got a bizarre story to tell.
It was 8:30 in the morning, and it was Mo, which is my niece's partner's mother, sort of mother-in-law. And Mo said, is that Pauline, Karen's sister? And I said, yes. Mo said, I've got a bit of a dilemma. I've had Chris here all night. And he's gone now, but he said he's killed Karen.
Pauline is blindsided by this shocking revelation.
Okay, I'll phone my mum and dad now and see where Karen is, and I'll go up to Karen's.
So Pauline went up in her car, and then she phoned me.
My dad said, I'm going to the tip, and I'll meet you at Karen's. I said, yeah, fine. I went to Mo's house, got the keys, and I went to Karen's house, and I was trying to open the door. She had a very fiddly door, you know, it was really... And luckily, I couldn't get in. And the police came then.
It was hard, but Peter took that phone call. I didn't. Peter took it and he went. He said to me, I gotta go. And he went. Didn't even say where he was going. He just said he was going. He said, Pauline was on the phone, I'm going. And I said, okay.
Mo had phoned the police as well, so luckily they arrived 2 minutes after me. When the police turned up, they obviously went in the house, and I stood on the gate, and the policeman walked out. And I can't even remember now whether he said it was code red or code blue, but it's code blue, and I said, is she in there? And he said, yes. And with that, my dad turned up.
He said, Daddy, he's killed her. That's the first we knew. And couldn't believe it.
I don't even know what we did. We went to the police station. And I had to see my dad cry. I just thank God I hadn't got it in the house. I don't know what I would have done. It was bad enough.
Peter came in and he said, you're not going to believe it. He's done it. I said, he's done what? He said, Chris has killed Karen. I said, the hell out you know?
I can't imagine anybody doing it. It was a shock. Now, yes, we could see how it would building up to that. But, I mean, when it happened, I mean, we didn't never expected that to happen.
Chris's alcohol-fueled confession to Mo turns out to be true. When Karen gets back from meeting her new boyfriend, she runs into Chris on the street. and Chris convinces her to come over to his house.
John, text her, missing you already, J. And he just put the initial J. The Karen was up in the bathroom and he picked it up and read it. And I think that was the start. I think that's what's done it, if you like.
He went into the bathroom and then tried to strangle her with a towel. And he then armed himself with a hammer, which was close by, and battered her about the head. I think he broke the hammer, and having done that, went and got another hammer from another part of the house.
After Chris brutally murders his wife, Karen, he sends a text message to John, saying, "Meeting Karen in Cardiff was the worst thing you ever did." Chris cleans up the crime scene after first going out to buy a bottle of whiskey, leaving the body in the house.
He'd gone to the shop and bought a bottle of whiskey because it was on camera. And then Chris went back to the house and cleaning up everything.
With the house clean, Chris roams the streets, claiming to be looking for Karen.
Killed her about, I think it was 5:30. And he was ringing my nan then to see if he'd seen her, when he was probably stood next to her.
Chris ends his search charade at his in-law's house and spends the entire night drinking with her and talking about his marriage and his relationship to Karen. Towards early morning, he confesses to Mo that he's killed Karen. Karen's family cannot believe what's happened.
It's like as though you're outside your body watching. It doesn't seem like you. It's really, really strange. I can't describe how I felt. Obviously, I was devastated. I don't mean it like that. But what I was doing and saying and things like this, I can't. It's quite blurred, the day.
I just couldn't believe it. Lost her. And it still hurts.
I wouldn't believe it for about 2 weeks. Like, I kept looking for her. And then after the funeral, then I spent the night in the cemetery by the side of her. That's when I finally accepted it.
After confessing the murder to Mo, Chris disappears. There are various sightings of him around town.
He was down the bingo hall looking for her when he just killed her.
The police search the streets urgently, looking for the confessed killer. No one knows what else he's capable of.
It was awful. Worst day of my life. Worst day.
At 9:08 a.m. on June 23, 2002, Karen Pugh is found dead, killed by 16 blows to the head. After confessing to the crime, her husband Chris is now nowhere to be found. Karen's family fears the worst. They are also afraid of what they might do to him if he does resurface.
I wanted to kill him. Stone dead. That's what I said.
Over the next several hours, the rumors about Chris's whereabouts run rampant, and many believe he'll resort to suicide.
If I'd have known he had drugs in his pocket and he was down the dock, I'd have pushed him in.
With every passing minute, the family becomes increasingly anxious. Chris is still nowhere to be found. But by 3:30 p.m., to everyone's surprise, Chris appears at the police station and unexpectedly turns himself in. He tells police that he believes he has committed a crime, but has no recollection of the event. He is detained while police sort out his bizarre story.
I just know that Chris gave himself up eventually. It was awful, worst day of my life.
Booster.
The next morning, the family is asked to identify Karen's body at the morgue.
Me and my brother, Michael, and my nan, we were all in the car to go and see my mum after she was murdered. We went to the hospital morgue. They covered up her head with a bandage. So I always remember she had a little tear in her eye.
By bizarre coincidence, Chris calls while they are there.
They just come out of seeing their mother dead. And I think it was Michael's phone that rang. And he spoke to him like as though they'd been shopping. And they were just on their way home from shopping.
Just 2 days after turning himself in, on June 25th, 2003, Chris is charged with the murder of Karen Pugh and remanded into custody. Several months later, Deanne visits her father in prison.
I just wanted answers, like, I wanted to know why. Why he did it. I wanted him to say sorry more than anything, I think. I didn't get any of that. He was just talking to me like it was something you do every day, or when I killed your mother. That's how he was talking to me, when I killed your mother, like it's just something you do every day.
On April 30th, 2003, just 11 months after Karen's death, Chris begins his trial for the murder of his wife. To Karen's family and the prosecution team, it seems like an open and shut case. They are wrong.
The charge was a simple charge of murder. It would appear on the charge sheet, given the date, on a certain date, Christopher Pugh murdered Karen Pugh, and that would be it. In English law, murder is murder. There are no degrees of murder.
When the trial started, or just, you know, as it was starting, the prosecution, we were not led to believe that there would be any problems. The evidence was quite straightforward. Chris had tried to strangle Karen, couldn't for whatever reasons, and went and got two hammers to make sure that she never got up again. And for that split second, I feel that he's thought about what he's going to do, so it's premeditated.
Efforts to clean up the crime scene afterwards, efforts to elude the police, at least for a while, all indicate that there was a consciousness of guilt. And the fact that he switched instruments in the course of the crime indicate that he was thinking, he was making decisions even during the crime.
The prosecution argues that he was lucid during the attack.
The fact that he used two hammers is pretty conclusive, usually in circumstances such as this, that you're not out of control. You're acting in a controlled and rational manner. To put down one hammer which is broken and then go and search for another and then come back and finish the act is pretty, pretty well deliberate. I think we thought we were home and dry in this case.
He found or got them two hammers and he killed her. He beat her 16 times on the head.
However, the defense creates a challenge for the prosecution by citing a little-known statute called the provocation law.
The important feature in this case was the law of provocation. And that provided that if by words or deeds immediately prior to the incident, someone was caused to lose his self-control and acted in a particular manner, then the proper verdict is one of not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter.
In short, the defense is claiming that Karen's actions provoked Chris into killing her. This is a law more often used in domestic abuse cases where the victim kills the batterer.
The core of the philosophical debate about provocation is whether or not there can be circumstances under which an otherwise rational person is so upset that he or she can no longer be expected to respond rationally.
Most of us have heard the expression, I saw red. And that leads us to believe that what the person is saying was, I really lost it. But the people that lose it remember their actions. And so I do think it's possible that Chris lost it, that he got angry, that he saw red. But that doesn't mean that he would have forgotten what he did.
Chris's, I suppose, lawyers were looking for was to blame Karen. That Karen was the Scarlet Woman, and Karen had broken the family home up.
There was some evidence raised by the defence that Karen had still returned to the matrimonial home from time to time, but it's quite clear that she still had feelings for him despite his conduct towards her, so that when he was able to persuade her to go back, she was very susceptible to be persuaded. And of course, it did result in the fact that she was sleeping with both at the same time.
But the prosecution remains confident that John's testimony will clear up any confusion about the state of Chris and Karen's abusive marriage. They're in for a big surprise. John chooses to testify from behind a screen because he is afraid of Chris. And to the family's horror, he tells the jury a very different side to the story. He testifies that Karen was chasing him and that it was creating problems in his marriage.
John was the boyfriend. He clearly featured in the case and was an important feature of it. As he had given material evidence of fact, necessary evidence of fact that we needed, we had to call him as a witness. He was a reluctant witness. He didn't want to come at all because Karen had gone. And I think at that stage, he was possibly back with his former wife. And so the last place he wanted to be was giving evidence in this case in court. His reluctance was also marked by the fact that he insisted on giving evidence from behind a screen.
John's testimony comes as a major blow.
John said that Karen hounded him, wouldn't leave him alone. And when he tried to break it off, she said she was going to tell his wife.
No one knows whose version is true.
I think John's testament's changed purely because he still had a life and he wanted that life with his wife.
All in all, not a good witness. Not a good witness, and a bit of a gift for the defence.
The jury is swayed by the defence's arguments. On May 9th, 2003, Christopher Pugh is acquitted of murder and convicted of manslaughter by means of provocation. He is sentenced to 6 years behind bars. But because of time already served, we'll only have to spend 3.
So a surprising verdict. I think everyone was surprised. And the very nature of the violence that was used in the course of the event, we thought took it far beyond what one would normally have thought would have been a reasonable case of provocation.
In his sentencing remarks, the judge deemed the attack with the hammer as excusable, considering the circumstances, and that his wife had driven him to lose control.
He apologized to Chris for the hard time he'd had. When summed up, he said, "You know, Mr. Pugh, he said, I know you've had a hard year, a very traumatic year," he said.
Chris said that Karen provoked him, and the judge said that it was provocation and that it was excusable. The 16 blows to the head was excusable because he was provoked. How can you have an excuse for hitting somebody, going to get the hammers and hitting somebody 16 times on the head? The evidence was there. Why? Why wasn't it murder? It wasn't a nasty accident that went wrong. It was murder.
Oh my God, I was devastated. I really was devastated. I can't think of another word for it. I really did break my heart. That's the time I cried. When he turned around, the judge, he was nearly in tears, talking to Chris, apologising.
Kathleen said she did have a little bit of happiness before she died with John. And that's the only consolation that we got, that she did have a little bit of happiness before she died with John.
I think I was gutted more for my nan and gramp because, like I said, for 23 years, they'd had to watch her being beaten and mentally abused and couldn't really do much in that respect. And then having to bury her and then having to live with the fact that there was no justice. And that ate away at my nan and gramp badly.
After spending 3 years behind bars for killing his wife with two hammers, Chris Pugh is released from jail in 2006.
It just pickles me like that he came out, picked his old job back up, and just carried on working. Like he was in there for like a parking ticket or something, or, you know, non-payment of something. Something trivial.
In the end, Karen's desire to keep her family together eventually tears it apart. Chris's children do not know which side to take.
The children no longer have a lot to do with one another. They don't really speak.
It's broke us up. It's broke a very, very close family up. I'll tell you what, she'd be with you 10 minutes and you'd love her. Everybody loved Karen. When she got buried, there was 250 people at her funeral. 250 people at her funeral. No, she was loved.